We have three cases for argument today. The first case is 2012-8001, Pyle v. Justice. Mr. Kilbourn?
Yes, ma'am.
You may proceed.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, I am James Kilbourn from the North Carolina Bar, and I represent Mr. Pyle, Detective Pyle, in this particular matter. Detective Pyle was injured protecting the people of Caldwell County, North Carolina. He suffered knee and back injuries while trying to apprehend a suspect on May 26, 2005. After several attempts to return to work, Detective Pyle was medically retired in 2009.
Mr. Kilbourn, what's the income reported in Mr. Pyle's 2009 and 2010 tax returns from Mountain Grove Church?
Your Honor, I can't tell you. And the reason I can't tell you is because that was not brought to our attention until after we had made all the submissions. There is no record in this case as to where that income came from because that tax return was requested after we had been allowed to file all the information. We believe the statute and the regulations suggest a much less adversarial system where when the director discovers something like that.
Did you submit the tax return?
We did upon request. We did not do so voluntarily. It was requested.
So what's wrong with that?
We would argue, Your Honor, that the way the regulation is set up, we should then have an opportunity for the director to come to us and say, we have a concern about this. Can you give us some evidence regarding what this is? Because the standard is
isn't that, there some mention in one of the briefs that it had to do with church music?
The director had done some independent investigation after we had submitted the record, which I first discovered whenever the determination was sent, that he was listed as a director of music. I don't know what that entails, nor do I know if that's gainful employment, gainful and substantial. I don't know if it was.
He made, as I recall, he made claims for some sort of deductions or expenses as well.
Travel expenses, yes, sir. Your Honor, I wish I could answer that question. And I think that's the reason I'm suggesting this court remand it so that the director can then ask those questions. We can provide the evidence.
Do the regulations require you to submit the tax return?
It requires us to submit it if they request it. And I think under this case, they did request it after all the other evidence had been presented by us. But there was no second request, as we would argue the 2004 regulations would suggest, the need to say to us, we've got a question about this. We want you to provide us some evidence. We could take a deposition of the.
But prima facie, gainful employment, if you're submitting tax returns and making claims for deductions for business purposes, isn't that gainful?
It has to be both gainful and substantial. It has to involve, it can't be a charity. We don't know if the church maybe brought him on as a charity. We don't know that.
What was it you missed? I mean, when you're giving that, I think what you're saying is that you're sort of like, you felt that there was a duty on behalf of the decision maker to help you by telling you that they had a problem as a result of the tax return.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. Okay.
Well, let's assume for purposes of argument your tax return showed you had $1 million of income. You wouldn't need any assistance to know that that's going to be very detrimental to your claim.
I would not know.
So is your argument here that the amount of income was sufficiently de minimis that you thought that it couldn't possibly have raised a concern and therefore the decision maker should have warned you that they were concerned about this?
I think this is not supposed to be an adversarial system. It's supposed to be a cooperative system, and under 28 CFR 32.21B in 2004 at the date of the injury, it indicates that the Bureau shall inform the claimant what evidence is necessary for determination and shall request the claimant submit such evidence within a reasonably specified time. We would argue, Your Honor, under that 2004 statute, you need to look at this particular evidence and we need to be able to be given an opportunity to answer that. Now, there's a second issue that I know this court has not addressed yet, which is the Social Security Administration determination.
Well, but can you tell me one thing before you move on to that? Why is it that you keep referring to the 2004 regulations? The regulations that apply in this case are the ones that were in place at the time of claim, right?
I respectfully disagree. I would argue that if you look at footnote one of the director's own decision, she cites to 28 CFR 32.4D, which is the current 32.4D, which says that unless the same shall expressly provide otherwise, any amendment to the Act in particular shall apply only to respect to the injuries occurring on or after the date it takes effect. So in other words, the regulation says that you use the Act as of the date of the injury. It is legally inconsistent and legally illogical to use the act from 2004 or 2005 and use the regulations from 2011. That doesn't make any legitimate sense because there have been changes to the act. So I would argue that it's the date of the injury that's
critical.
Doesn't
the regulation say, my law clerk just pinged me, the regulation says it's explicitly applicable to the claims filed before that. So doesn't the regulation on its face tell you what it's applicable to?
I would argue, Your Honor, that this court has addressed this issue several times. They addressed it in Woodward, and in Woodward they said you can't change the regulations in the middle of the game. They also said they had grave concerns about this retroactive application of the regulations. It also looked at it in Juneau, where this court looked at it under both the old regulations and the new regulations, determined that it was the same outcome. And then in Groff, the other case that cited, it doesn't even address the issue, but it looks at it under the old regulations. I would say, Your Honor, that if the law changes, but if the law stays the same, regardless of what date of injury, then the regulation changing would not be, I would say, logical and consistent. So we have argued that you should look at the 2004 regulations on the date of the injury, just like you look at the act on the date of the injury.
So I would have to hold that it was that the regulation, which on its face says it applies to all already filed claims, is void as what, unconstitutional? What is your, how am I avoiding this regulation, which on its face tells me that I have to use?
I would argue that on its face it's not as clear as that. That there is some indication that it does apply, but on its face it's not that clear. I would also argue, Your Honor, that there's not a significant justification for the changes made in 2006.
The language says to be effective and applicable to all claims from and after the effective date hereof, whether pending in any stage as of that date or subsequently filed.
This court in Woodward already said that provision doesn't apply in certain cases. It says that it cannot apply to pending cases. That's what Woodward stands for. So we would argue that this court hasn't addressed that issue, and just like Woodward found that under the Landsgraf factors that is inappropriate to apply retroactive regulations, we would argue that in this case it would be inappropriate as well because it can lead to a different outcome, and it's a significant change in the standard, and that's what we would argue is critical in this particular case. And again, I would point you to that footnote 1 where obviously the act is being applied from 2004. We would argue that the regulations in place at the time of the act would be appropriate as well. Any more questions on that issue? I wanted to go in for a second to the Social Security Administration because I think this is critical as well. I don't know whether this court's going to address that or not. Obviously, we've had motions before you that I'm sure will be part of the determination. But the Social Security Administration had a similar set of facts in front of them. They had these...
But different standards.
Slightly different standards, but similar. They're similar enough where we would argue that you should remand this case to have the director consider this, that under these circumstances, you have the two issues of the Social Security Administration under similar standards saying it's not gainful and substantial, and we have some issue here where we were not allowed to present evidence of the facts behind this particular incident. Those two things under this statute, which has been held to be remedial in nature and should be applied, not be applied grudgingly, but should be construed liberally.
That's true.
Under these circumstances, we would argue that a remand back to the director to consider these issues is important. And certainly the issue of regulations, we argued under one set of regulations and that they decided under another. We would argue that all those factors are critical for determining the outcome in this particular case.
Your client's tax returns in front of the Social Security Administration?
I would assume so, Your Honor. You know, as I understand
yes
it.
Or no, yes or no?
I don't know. I did not handle that case, but I would assume the Social Security Administration, ALJ, would have access to all the
but
Social
whether
Security
or not they
records.
Actually looked at it, that was my question. I mean, you're making the argument that the SSA factual record was exactly on all fours with what was in front of justice.
I can't make that argument. What I can say is that they would have had similar considerations in front of them. It would surprise me if...
Well, they may or may not have looked at it, but it would seem to me that it's your burden if you're arguing essentially that the SSA in this case must be given some weight because all of the evidence was the same, then I refer to the tax records because it struck me that the income from the church was probably what did you in at the justice.
Well,
that's what struck me as right. as really harmful to your case.
I do admit that that's a question that needs to be answered, Your Honor.
Does the SSA decision refer to the tax returns?
I did not see it within it, but I would argue that the Social Security Administration has access to the Social Security records.
I know they have access. Gee whiz.
Right. And I would assume that they look at how much money you made and whether you worked. That's probably the key question that the Social Security Administration is answering through the ALJ is, did he work? And, you know, when they have access as the Social Security Administration to the Social Security records that he would have filed Social Security and Medicare on this particular transaction, I would argue that it's logical to assume they had access to it.
You agree that the regulation actually gives a definition for what gainful work means, right?
It does.
Full or part-time activity that actually is compensated or is commonly compensated. That's a pretty broad definition of gainful work. And if we don't agree with you on your regulatory argument, so substantial is out the window and the only requirement in the regs is gainful work, I don't see how, regardless of the circumstances behind the tax returns in and of themselves are not enough to meet this definition. That's the problem I'm contending with right now. I mean, do you have a response to that?
I would say first and foremost, I believe the 2004 regulations would apply. That's for this court to decide. I'm not going to put myself in that position. But looking at even under the current regulations, there's still that question out there that what happens is the directors are basically a defense attorney and a judge is going out there doing investigation, looking at websites, finding tax records, and then not...
But if all of that is disregarded as cumulative of the tax return, I mean, just the tax return alone, why isn't that substantial evidence that supports what the director decided to do, that this is gainful employment?
I would argue that you can't just look at a tax return and say it's gainful employment. There's many different ways that a church and many different reasons a church could be giving someone money and could be giving someone taxable money. And I would argue that those questions are what needs to be answered.
Right, but if it had been a gift, it wouldn't have been taxable. If what you're suggesting is that it was eleemosynary, that basically it wasn't work for work, it was church just gave them the money, then they wouldn't have filed the tax returns. You don't pay tax on gifts.
There are many stages between full-time or part-time employment and a gift, I think, that could fit anywhere. You have many agencies like Goodwill and places that attempt to employ people with disabilities that
they're
may not be.
They're still being employed.
That's gainful employment, isn't it?
They're getting paid.
I again would argue that the older statute should apply. And as well, Your Honor, I think the Social Security Administration had this before them. And these kind of questions are not questions for this court to be able to answer because there wasn't enough record below because this particular claim became adversarial rather than the cooperative search for truth, I think that the Congress intended on this statute.
You're into your rebuttal time. You've got 2 minutes left. Do you want to save it?
I guess I better sit down, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Wolak.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Government respectfully requests that this Court affirm the decision of the Director. Essentially, I think as we've argued in our brief, this court need not address many of the questions that are presented by the petitioner here today because the result is the same under either the old or the new regulations that they're arguing for.
Do we know that? How do we know that if you have a different test that the decision maker would come up the same?
We don't believe that there is a different test.
Well, I understand that, but you said under either test, you're going to win either way, so we don't have to decide whether the 2004 regs apply.
I'm sorry. If I said test, what I meant to say was the regulations, as they're formulated with respect to gainful activity. Before 2006, it is gainful work activity. After 2006, it is gainful work. The wording of the definitions of those two phrases are different, but essentially boiled down to, is it an activity that is done for compensation or that can be compensated? And as this court has suggested in its questions to petitioner's counsel, Mr. Pyle was compensated in 2009 and 2010 for his work at the Mountain Grove Church. And to answer one of the questions I believe that Judge Wallach asked about, if we know how much he made in 2009, that answer is at Joint Appendix 427, it's W-2, $7,800, by the way.
Do we know whether or not the tax returns were in front of the Social Security Administration decision maker?
We don't. The government doesn't. What we have is the copy of the decision that was submitted by the petitioner, and we don't have any of the backup. There is a paragraph in that decision that indicates how much money he earned in both 2009 and 2010.
Those numbers jive with what the tax return showed?
The 2010 number does, yes.
Yep.
And, I mean, the director based her decision.
What's your response to Mr. Pyle's argument that Woodward takes away the argument that the regulation means what it says on its face? The new reg says it applies to pending cases. And Mr. Pyle says, well, that can't be so because Woodward held that the old reg applied to a pending case.
Respectfully, Woodward seems to be a bit of an outlier.
It's not an outlier. I mean, he's arguing that it's inconsistent. He's saying that that Woodward has decided the issue that's in front of us, which is whether or not the 2004 reg applies to a pending case.
Respectfully, Woodward did not decide that precise
issue.
Help me out. Woodward, we would urge, is limited to its facts, I believe, indicates that it's limited to its facts. And what Woodward did was, there are the Landsgraf factors that, of course, the court is familiar with from the Supreme Court for determining retroactivity. Woodward doesn't cite that. Instead, it cites Princess Cruz's sort of a glancing acknowledgement of the Landsgraf factors, but ultimately decides the case based on what it says was evidence that in the prosecution of the claim, the petitioner, the claimant, actually made strategic decisions based on the old regulations. Woodward, to the extent it stands for anything, suggests that there is this strategic consideration and that there should be a record developed that would suggest that perhaps there was detrimental reliance. In our discussions, we call that the Woodward rule. That's the shorthand that I've been using for that. It is much more limited than the traditional retroactivity analysis, and it, again, is based on a record of reliance. And what we don't have in this case is any reliance by the petitioner on the old regulations. In fact, we have evidence that they didn't rely on the old regulations, but repeatedly to refer to and structure their arguments around the new regulations in their opening brief. And I believe, as mentioned by Mr. Kilbourn in his opening statements, referred to the director's responsibility, he believes, to inform Mr. Pyle that the director might be ruling against him. And in his brief at page 34, he cites 28 CFR 32.14C. That's a current regulation. Yeah. Leaving aside our position that he's incorrect about his assertion about what that means, it's still a current regulation. In the joint appendix of 445 to 46, Mr. Pyle, when he requested reconsideration of the initial decision, cited 28 CFR 32.28. Again, current regulation. At JA 451, the request for director review cites 28 CFR 32.52. Again, the current regulation. And in the transcript of the proceedings before the director, the opening statement to the director mentions that they know that they have to establish certain medical facts by clear and convincing evidence. That is a standard that was implemented in 2006, the current regulations, not the old ones. There is no evidence, and the petitioner cites none, that they made any strategic decisions based upon the old regulations. And if we look at the record, there is actually evidence in the record suggesting that they did not do what they assert to do.
As I read the explanation of the new regulation, 2004 regulation in the Federal Register, it says that the law is that if a statute is changed, then the applicant gets the benefit of the law that was in place at the time of the event, not the later statutory change. Is that correct? That's what the regulation says.
Yes, that is what the regulation
says. And the regulation says that notion that with regard to a statutory amendment, the applicant gets the benefit of the law in place at the time of the event, doesn't apply to regulations.
It
says regulations, the regulation that is later enacted even, you know, during the course of the litigation will apply. Doesn't that strike you as strange to have a different rule for statutes and for regulations?
I always feel constrained to say what I particularly
think. Yeah, but I mean, I'm just asking. The law seems to be that an applicant will be taxed with whatever the law was at the time of the event. A later change in law, either favorable or unfavorable, won't apply. Then if that's the case, why does it make sense to have regulations be treated differently?
If I might answer by going one step beyond the question that was not discussed before. The law that we're talking about here, the statute 3796B, didn't change in 2004.
I understand that. My point is that where an agency sets itself up and says, well, we're going to treat the law that applies here as the law as of the day of the event, but notwithstanding that, we're going to allow you to make a regulation right in the middle of the lawsuit and have that regulation apply. Seems strange to me.
The benefit that is provided underneath this particular scheme is, as the Supreme Court has acknowledged, a gratuity. It is not something that a law enforcement officer can earn. It is something that the federal government provides as a matter of legislative grace, I believe. The amendments in 2004 in the legislative history and the preamble to it cite a statement by one of the representatives expressly stating that it is a gratuity, as acknowledged by the Supreme Court, that this is a program that has the Bureau, as an integral part of determining whether or not someone may receive the benefit. That is, they are not independent. It's not simply that a claimant can come in and say, I've met the standards, therefore, Bureau Director, you are obligated to provide this to me. You are a minister. They have to meet the standards to the Bureau Director's satisfaction. The statute says that. The regulations say that. Congress was very clear about that. And I think in seven instances, Congress makes reference to its delegation to the Bureau for rulemaking authority. This is a unique situation. So it might strike the court as odd, but this is a fairly unique component of the federal government and a fairly unique benefit that is provided to people. Actually, I think I've answered all the notes that I took.
Anything further?
If there's any.
There's I think no, we have your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just really quickly.
While you're up, Mr. Kilburn,
yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you before, I'm going to ask you now, to address my other concern, which is the weight of the medical evidence. The question is there substantial evidence to support the decision? And you've got a mixed bag here at best. I mean, even most of the doctors, except for Lawrence, who generally says he's doing fine, don't say he can't do anything. They say Mr. Powell's incapable of doing what he did. That's pretty clear, that he can't function as a detective. But they don't say he can't do gainful employment.
Well,
sitting down playing music, for example.
Yeah, I think there are things in each one of them, and doctors never say exactly what lawyers want them to say. That's the reality of practicing law. But each one of them, Stanislaw, for example, in J33, says it's unlikely he'll ever be able to obtain any type of gainful employment. Maxie also says it's fairly significant disability here, and Mr. Powell is going to be significantly limited, I think, permanently. They're not going to say exactly the legal standard, but if you look at each of the experts in their deposition or in their statement, they're going to give that information. On the other side, you have the director imposing her own expert opinion in place of these expert opinions, as well as a cardiologist.
But it doesn't seem to be in place. It seems like you can read it as there's substantial evidence to support the decision.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I would say that each of the doctors who treated him say in one part or another that there's a significant disability, and together they put the puzzle together.
But they do say there's a significant disability, but they also say that he can do some stuff. And the question is, can he do gainful employment? Not can he go back and work as a detective. There he can't.
My time's expired. May I answer?
You go ahead, please.
I would say, Your Honor, that if you look at the medical evidence, if you look at what the doctors actually said in their deposition or in their affidavits, you'll see that each one of them said either all of the puzzle or a piece of the puzzle. Their notes may be different, but their actual statements at the end, looking back on his entire treatment, are very different than what the director seems to find within the notes itself. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. We thank both counsel for their arguments.